So today I would like to pick up on our own why we practice, the things that we've learned, and I want to talk a little bit about how my own experience in the secular mindfulness world and how that meets with our Dharma practice. And I want to talk about that somewhat through what are the teachings that have been so instrumental for me and how they apply to my life in my work. And this is a little bit separate from, these are more of the core teachings that I'm thinking about. So as we look at mindfulness, there are, because it's so pervasive in our culture now, I think that there are lots of ways that people understand mindfulness. There are lots of ways people misunderstand mindfulness. And sometimes I get the response when people say to me, "Oh, what do you do?" And I say that I'm a small business owner and I teach mindfulness. I get a bit of an eye roll. Do you ever get the eye roll? We know about this, right? So I think that when people are rolling their eyes, what are they rolling their eyes about? Is it that there's a misunderstanding about mindfulness or an undervaluing of it? And also, is it seen as just the next new age fad? Or is it cool to talk about mindfulness? Or, all of that. So I think it's a very interesting thing for those of us who are practitioners, and this is really a core part of our lives, that when we get the eye roll, that it doesn't intimidate us to talk about what this is and why it's so important and how it actually manifests in our lives, not evangelically, but when somebody says, "So, what are you up to? Why do you do this? What do you get out of this practice?" And I think it's very important for us to each work on that a little bit. What is mindfulness for us? So I said a little bit earlier that I am a small business owner and I teach mindfulness. So my business, I own a laundromat, and it's a big, busy neighborhood laundromat in Arcata. I have about 10 employees, and we do a lot of customer service. It's open every day. It's not open 24 hours, but most of my employees are under 30. I would say half are students. There's a university in Arcata, so it's a great job while somebody is in school. But we also have people who are parents who work for us. And my goal when I started this business with my business partner, who's since retired, the business has been there almost 18 years, was that it would be a clean, safe, and dignified place for people to do their laundry and for people to work. Because that's what I want for me. I want a dignified, clean, safe place to work. And laundry is one of those things that cuts across every socioeconomic level, right? We all have dirty laundry. It's the common denominator. So how can we take something as regular and ordinary as dirty laundry and make it a positive experience? So what I wanted in this store was to be a community place where people felt really safe and not diminished because I have to go to a laundromat, because we've got these stereotypes of what laundromats are. So we made a very distinct effort to make it a really beautiful place. And it's very clean. It doesn't have the typical sort of metal, plastic, like bus station row chairs, that you sit in. That's not what the store is. The store has some wood trim. It's got nice art on the walls. It's got nice big windows and nice people who work there. And in fact, about 15 years ago, we were named America's Most Beautiful Laundromat. What an oxymoron, right? You wouldn't really think that. What would that be? By the Coin Laundry Association of America is who gave us that award. And I take great pride in that because it is a beautiful place. It is a place where people can feel safe coming to do their laundry. And it's not all a bed of roses because it's people, so it's difficult. And things happen and we've got to figure out how to work with people. You know, customer service is tough. So it's been a great practice ground for me, for sure. And through all of this time, I've been a practitioner, and it's been a very interesting thing as my teaching has grown and grown to figure out how I can bring the practice as the employer, as everybody's boss, into our staff development as a core component. So mostly I have to practice and study. That's mostly where it comes from. And I can be somewhat overt about it, but I wear different hats, so I can't really teach so overtly about mindfulness to my staff. I mostly just need to lead by example. But as I was teaching more and more, and as I mentioned, I did this training at UCLA, one of the core components of the UCLA training was curriculum development, which is what I really wanted to do, because I really believe that when we bring the values of mindfulness practice into our workplace, we change the workplace for the better. So I'm very interested in bringing secular mindfulness programs into small business, into work environments as core components of staff development. So that's part of what I'm doing. And I can't really bring a structured program into my own business, but I am working to bring all these components in. And so it's a process, and it's very, very interesting to watch what happens when I can bring little pieces in. As an example, people get upset. You know, customers get upset. One of the things, if one customer leaves some chapstick in their pocket of their laundry and it goes through the dryer, and then the next person puts their clothes in the dryer, they get this waxy, sticky stuff all over their clothes. Then they take their clothes out of the dryer and they're upset, right? Naturally, they're upset. So my staff then needs to know how to address not only how are we going to get it out, which there are actually some really good ways to get it out, and we've learned that, but also to acknowledge to the person, I know you're upset, this is a bummer, because it is. That's what the truth is. It is. It's not what you expected, just like Sylvia says. It's not what I wanted, but it's what I got. So how can we, in these customer service roles, really acknowledge that I'm so sorry this happened. Let me work on it for you. So one of the things that I do with my staff when I can see that they're getting triggered by customers who are upset is I do give them the instruction of feel your feet on the ground. As you feel that reactivity going up, 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 because the customer you're working with is upset, and so that interaction gets upset, 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 really feel your feet on the ground. Or if they can't get to their feet, I just say, just put your hands on the counter and just feel the coolness of the surface of the counter. It will help redirect the energy down. And we can all do that when we get triggered, is that ability to just remember, right? Remember, oh, all right, I can feel my body right here. This is why mindfulness of the body is so important and functional. It's not just something that we do sitting on the cushion. We actually employ this in our daily interactions. So that's been really helpful for the staff. So back to these teachings that I like to work with for myself. One, I mean, you may be familiar with this. The Buddha said, what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? Are you familiar with that teaching? It's beautiful. I read a book from Tanisaro Biko, from a book of his talks, and he talks a lot. It's a book on self and not self. But he really looks at this question that I don't know what sutta it came from, but it's what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? I think this is a core question, because that way we can apply wise effort. We can look at our intentions, we can look at our actions, we can look at our speech. What, when I do it, will support me? What, when I do it, really doesn't support me? And we have to practice with that, right? We know that sometimes these things work, sometimes it doesn't work, and can we be aware enough to notice, okay, that didn't work so well, you know, and those are the habit patterns that we get into. So I like that question a lot. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? I remember sitting on retreat a number of years ago. Mary Grace Orr was teaching, and she was alluding to this when she said, you know, when you're stuck, you're confused, you might think, what would my 85-year-old self tell me to do about this? Isn't that great? Because we hope that when we're 85, we're in the fullness of our wisdom, that we're have some capacity to have some perspective. But I think that wisdom, that core of our wisdom, is always there. And so if we can just settle back, take a moment, and think about it, what is for our long-term welfare here? So that's a helpful one. The other teaching that I love is, by protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. This is really important. This, I think, that we can use over and over and over again to understand that when I really care for myself, I am caring for another. It is a protection. We can look at it in something as everyday as traffic rules. If we all abide by the same traffic rules, pretty much we'll be safe. But when that doesn't happen, when somebody runs a red light, everything changes. So that's a rather everyday, mundane way to look at it. But if you start thinking about it, you'll see how this can really manifest in different ways. And we'll talk more about that. The other guidepost for me, and I think of these as compass questions or just guideposts, is the intentional, on-purpose choice to act with kindness, to just choose kindness over and over again. When we get triggered and we're about to shoot the arrow, right? Can we stop long enough to say, all right, I don't need to react like that. How can I move through this time with a little more kindness? And it takes the intentional pause. It takes the awareness, the mindfulness to know, oh God, I got really slammed on this one. How do I want to be? And I remember this with my kids when they were little, that I would say to them, as really, really little kids, like 2 and 3 years old, instead of over and over again, be nice, it was, I wanted to make that more of an act, more of something they could choose. Choose kindness. So I remind myself about that over and over again. So those are the guideposts I like to use a lot. So getting back to how does that apply to our lives in secular mindfulness? In November, I went to a very large conference in Washington, D.C. called the Mindful Leadership Summit. It was very interesting. There were all different kinds of leaders there, people who were business leaders, educators, people in healthcare, people in Fortune 500 companies. There were the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, was there, very interesting man named Greg Fisher, who's done groundbreaking work for the city, and he's a practitioner, and he is very serious about what it means to have Louisville be a compassionate city and to deal with racism and all the ways that we see racism and bigotry come out in cities. He's really directly addressing it. One of the things that he does is every city employee, if I got this right, every city employee is given 2 hours paid time every week to volunteer in the community. Isn't that extraordinary that a city would pay for that? That's community building. That's just amazing. So I got inspired about that, and I'm going to do that in my business. I can't do it every week, but we're going to take a half a day a year and close the store, and I'm going to pay everybody, and we will go do some work for a nonprofit that I haven't figured out yet, which is going to be. But so it doesn't have to be on the scale of what a larger city can do. We can take these kinds of acts and just do what we can in smaller ways. So anyway, I went to this conference, and Richie Davidson was there, who is a leading neuroscientist and out of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And there were journalists and, like I said, all different kinds of people, and some Dharma leaders also. Joan Halifax was there teaching on compassion. And Jonathan Faust was there. He is a meditation teacher out of Kripalu, married to Tara Brach. He was there. Reverend Angel Kyodo Williams out of Berkeley, she was there talking about othering and how we manage that. It was very, very interesting, but 750 people getting together to talk about secular mindfulness. It was very amazing. So what I got out of it was that there was lots and lots of talk about the benefits of mindfulness and people really waving the flag of how great mindfulness is and how it changes lives. And Fortune 500 companies that have got, that are big global companies like BlackRock and SAP, if you're familiar, that have departments of mindfulness in their organizations, which is amazing that that's actually happening. But I appreciated so much Richie Davidson when he was being interviewed. He said, you know, and he's the neuroscientist, he's the one really doing the research, who said, you know, I can't tell you that mindfulness is going to cure high blood pressure, cure depression, and goes on and on with all the ailments. He said, it's going to help. But after all, this practice is about awakening. And I really appreciated that so much, that he said it out loud in that secular environment full of all these kinds of, who knows who was there. Certainly there were Dharma practitioners there. But we do need to say out loud that this practice is about awakening. And then we can define awakening, these moments of understanding that help us live a more skillful, wise life. It's not the big poof, right, that everything is then wonderful thereafter. But I did appreciate that a person like that was willing to say that. So through my experience of this conference, I felt there was a big gaping hole in what was not discussed. Now, I want to say there were so many people and lots of breakout sessions with different people talking about it that I couldn't hear everybody. But what I felt the gaping hole was is that when we practice, it gets uncomfortable, right? This is hard work. This is really hard work. This is not about sitting down and just having the peaceful, pleasant, lovely sit after sit. It's not like that. When we sit down, we come into all of our stuff. And when we're dedicated to this, we're willing to be with all of our stuff. So I really want to talk about that. I want that part of our practice to come out in our conversations about what it is we're doing. When we sit, we get to know ourselves in such a more refined way over time. Is that not your experience? But, the famous expression, no mud, no lotus. We sit in the mud, and out of that, that's how the lotus blooms. So one of the things that I also take exception with as a business leader and as a business owner are the claims that mindfulness practice will increase profitability and increase the bottom line. I want to know how they figured that out. Because I know for sure that a happier, more stable staff is a more productive staff, is a more efficient staff. We have less turnover. We have more camaraderie. That's the bottom line. We're talking about expanding the bottom line of our heart. That's the profitability that I'm looking at, because I know that when my staff feels supported, that that does support the business overall. But to draw a line from, here's the Department of Mindfulness, and we can bring our staff into this room and teach them to meditate once a week for a half an hour or two, my sales have gone up this much, I wonder. And maybe somebody's got that research. But it's not a straight line. It is just not a straight line, because we're human beings. So I like talking about a different bottom line. Because when we develop this bottom line of our heart, that's when we can really come into our fullness in whatever we're doing. So I want to tell you a story. Last Thanksgiving, just a few months ago, I got a call on Friday. We were closed on Thanksgiving Day. And on Friday morning, I got a call from my manager who said, I think we have a problem and I need your direction on this. When the employee who closed, we'll call him Luke, when Luke closed on Wednesday night, before we were closed for the holiday, Luke was our most junior employee, brand new, so he's learning the ropes. He found $100 in one of the washers. So, you know, periodically, not so periodically, people put money in their pockets, right? And they forget to empty their pockets and they do their laundry. And we have a system that when we find customers' laundry, either in their laundry, their washer, their dryer, and we know whose laundry that is, we have a system for returning the money. But this was five $20 bills left in a washer, and the store was closed. So Luke didn't know what to do with it. He wrapped it up in some blue gauze tape, and he stuck it in our back room on a shelf with a note that said, lost and found. So on Friday morning, he called, bless his heart, first thing in the morning, and he talked to another employee who'd been there a long time, and he said, I didn't know what to do with it. This is what I did. What should I have done? And can you go take care of it? And where should we put it? So, you know, I so appreciated that he called and he said, this is what I did. So Bob, the employee who was there, said, all right, great. And he told him what he should have done with it. And he went back to get the money. And when he went back to retrieve the money, it wasn't there. And we couldn't find it anywhere. But what was there was the ring of blue gauze tape on the top of the garbage that was next to the shelf where Luke had left the money. So when I got the call, what do we do about this? I thought to myself, oh no, who was in the store? What happened? When did this happen? But mostly what I thought was, what am I going to do about this? And I really thought about that for a long time. What am I going to do about this? What is the best response to this? I needed to find out what happened with the money. I needed to backtrack and figure out who was in the store during the time that we were closed and should not have been in the store. And then once I figured that out, I needed to then make another plan. So thankfully, we have security cameras that shine right into this office area. And I did know that our floor maintenance people were going to be there over the holiday. And I really did not want to find out that it was the floor maintenance people who had taken money. They've been cleaning our floors for over 15 years. They do a good job. And I didn't want to make any assumptions. I really wanted to just go on, what do I know to be true? What can I find out and how can I proceed? So we looked at the security camera, and what it showed us, in fact, that it was not the floor maintenance people, but in fact, it was one of my employees who had come in on Thanksgiving afternoon. And this is an employee who is great at her job. And she's an integral part of the staff. I rely on her. I like her. I trust her judgment. And here she came in the back door Thanksgiving afternoon, ostensibly to borrow some chairs that we keep for our staff meeting. So number one, you know, nobody should be in the store who isn't authorized when the store is closed. And borrowing our equipment without asking is also not okay. And they all know me well enough that they can get in touch with me and say, hey, Heidi, can I borrow some chairs? And I'm going to say, of course, take the chairs, just bring them back later. So Susan came in and she got the chairs and was in and out a couple of times, clearly taking them to her car. And then when she was done, she came in and her back was to the camera and I could see her looking in the direction of where the money was on the shelf. And there was a pause and then she left pretty quickly, turned the lights off and did not reset the alarm. And did not reset the alarm probably because she was nervous is my hunch. So now I knew what happened with the money, and I really had to think about what is the best thing to do here. What do I know to be true? By protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. That was what was coming in. What is the right action? How am I going to do this? Because I know that when I have to terminate somebody's employment quickly like that, it sends shockwaves through the staff. It's really hard on everybody else, and I really work hard to maintain a stable, cohesive staff. Yet, this was a big breach of trust. So it would be bad for the staff for me to have to do that, and also bad for me, because this is Thanksgiving weekend, and she had enough hours in the weekly schedule that it was going to have a real impact. And to try to find somebody immediately to take her place was a very, very difficult on me. So I'm also thinking about what's best for me here. So as I am deciding what to do, you would think that I have a zero tolerance policy for drugs and alcohol, that we would also have a zero tolerance policy for theft. But we don't. And we don't because it's not as black and white as drugs and alcohol when we really get down to it. It's what are the circumstances? What happened here? This was not a case of Susan going into the cash register and helping herself to money. This was what I really believe was a case of her having a moment of utter mindlessness. I think all of us at some point have taken something that wasn't ours, that wasn't freely given, even if it was stealing a piece of bubble gum when we were a kid. I took stamps from my grandfather's desk. I remember this really clear. Actually, I forgot about this till just right now. I used to love to sleep over at my grandparents' house, and I would sleep on the couch in my grandfather's study, and he had one of those cool little stamp dispensers that you could pull out, you know, the little brass ones with the screw on the top and a slit on the side, those round ones, and you could pull out this long strand of stamps. And I remember I took a bunch of stamps. I had been to summer camp and I was writing letters to my friends. And I came home after spending the night and one of my parents said, "Where did you get all these stamps?" So I was busted right away, and I remember having to call up my grandfather and tell him that I took the stamps, and he said, "Well, that's okay, honey, you can have them. Thank you for telling me, you know, just don't do that again." So you know, I think that I would be surprised if none of us has never taken something that wasn't freely given, that precept, right? So how do we really live these precepts? I undertake the training not to take that which is not freely given. So I also really believe in our fundamental decency. I think that it gets clouded. I think we mess up. I think that lots of things get in our way, and that's why we practice. But I really think that we are all fundamentally very decent human beings. And I really believe this about my employee, and I know her work is really good. So I didn't want to fire her. So my plan was that I needed to confront her about it. And what I did is I made sure I had one of my managers in the conversation with me, because I know that having two sets of ears and eyes is better than one set, so we can all hear what's happening. My plan was to talk with her about, just to let her know what happened, let her know what I saw in the video, and let the conversation just unfold from there and let her tell me what happened. And I really hoped that she was just going to tell me what happened and that, yes, she took the money. And my plan was also that if she didn't, that I would terminate her employment, because then that was really obvious that that would be the appropriate thing to do. So we had our meeting. She came in. And I said, this is what happened. This money was here. And now it's not. Do you know what might have happened with this? And she said, well, I did come in to borrow chairs, but I didn't see any money. And I said, okay, well, let me tell you what I saw in the video. So I told her what I saw in the video, and I could just see her feeling mortified, just awful. And somewhere in that conversation, I said, well, you know, the only thing we found was this ring of blue gauze tape, and I had taken it out of the garbage, and I said, see, it's right here. And she took a breath, and she looked away, and then she looked back at me right in the eye, and she said, I'm really embarrassed because I lied. I did take the money. It happened really fast, and I want to give it back to you. And she handed me the $100 right then. And I just really thanked her. And it was really hard for her to admit that. She said, you know, I came in to get the chairs, and then I saw the money, and I just took it. And I said, okay. So I said, how do you want to proceed? Because what I wanted to do in that was not to just say, all right, now this is what's going to happen. I'm going to take you off the schedule. We're going to figure out how we're going to reestablish trust. But I wanted to include her in that process. So I said to her, so Caitlin, if you were in my shoes, what would you do? How would you handle this? And she said, well, I would take me off the schedule for a few days, and I would ask me not to work, and I would figure out how we could rebuild the trust. And I said, okay. I said, that's great. So that's what we did. So we figured out the schedule, and we moved on. And I was glad she said that, because I had already taken her off the schedule, and I had already found substitutes for the next couple of shifts, and then I knew that we would rebuild that. So one of the things I also did is I had her give me her store key back and asked her not to be in the store alone, and that I really wanted to work on reestablishing that trust. So that was fine. That was the end of it. And a couple of days later, she called me in the morning and said, you know, I'm at work, and I know you don't want me to be in the store by myself, but I need to cover my coworker's break. What would you like me to do? Good girl, huh? And I said, you know, I just want you to be your best self. That's it. Just be your best self. And that was the end of it. And I think that's all we all want to do, is to be our best selves. But we need environments that support us to be our best selves. So what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness. That was part of it. And by protecting myself, I'm protecting others. And by protecting others, I'm protecting myself. The other thing I did ask her to do was to make amends with the employees who knew what had happened. Everybody didn't know what had happened, and everybody didn't need to know. But her coworker, who couldn't find the money and then subsequently watched the video, knew what had happened. And my manager, who watched the video and called me and told me who it was, she was good friends with her, and she was just heartsick. So, how do we work with that place of when we have those breaches that are so painful? So this employee did go to to her coworkers, and I don't know what she said, but, you know, they're mature enough that they'll work through that. And so far, so good. The other thing I did say to her is, please prove me right that I'm making the right decision here, that I'm betting on your best self here, because I know that's in there. So I don't think that I could have done that without practice. I really don't. Because our reactive default setting is, if you betray me, I'm out of here, right? That's what we do, because it's so painful to be with betrayal in any way that it shows up. It requires thinking outside the box. It requires being able to really sit with, this is painful. How do I want to be? What do I want to do? On the back door of the back door of our, this back room at the laundromat, where the office is, there's a door that leads out into the laundromat itself. And on this door going out is a bumper sticker that says, do no harm. Have you ever seen those bumper stickers? I actually got it here at the end of retreat years ago, when all the tables are set up in the upper hall with all of the books and stuff. There was this big pile of bumper stickers, and I don't know who brought it, but I took one and I put it up on the door. And you know, it's like any sign, you stop seeing it after a while. But when I hire new employees, and with all of our staff meetings, which are in this back room, I remind them, do no harm. And what does this mean, right? It's quite a big, tall order to define non-harming. It's big because it's got many different convolutions and permutations. So this is an intention to work on non-harming, to bring it into our awareness of how we work and what is our daily life like. I remember reading, did anybody read Joseph Goldstein's newest book, Mindfulness? Have you seen it? It's a masterwork. It's in the bookstore. And it's a study of the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. And it is based on several years of talks that Joseph gave on the Satipatthana Sutta. There were 46 talks in all. And I learned a lot. I got a lot of education out of listening to those talks. It took me about a year, and I listened to each one of them twice. And it was a great process. But he tells a story about going to his teacher and saying that his mindfulness was just kind of dry. His practice was just kind of dry. His mindfulness felt really, really strong, but it was dry. And he was just not feeling a lot of juice in his practice. And his teacher said, Joseph, remember your sila. Now, sila is our ethical practice, right? And when he said, remember your sila, Joseph's response was, oh my God, what did I do wrong? Because that's kind of what we would go to. You know, if somebody tells us, well, remember your ethical practice. Instead, it's a practice of remembering our ethical life because it supports us. It's a cause for happiness. So it's a reminder that when we take these precepts seriously as a training, and non-harming covers all of them, right? Not stealing, not lying, our wise speech, supporting life, not taking life, our sexuality, what we take in, what we consume. So to live a life of non-harming is an ongoing practice question for us, I think indefinitely. So remembering our sila. As Joseph says, remember the practice of sila involves training, not commandments, and that even after lapses, we can retake the precepts and begin again. This enables us to appreciate all the times we have lived by this commitment to non-harming, and it also allows us to learn from those times we haven't. And I think that's the other piece of practice that is so beautiful, is that it allows us to learn from the times when we've had the lapses without all of the judgment. We get the space to say, okay, blew it. All right, I'm still here. It's okay. And we have ways of making amends. We have ways of forgiving ourselves. And the compassion practice is so important. So important for that. So then we can reflect on wholesome and unwholesome actions. And there's a counterintuitive teaching, which is a little bit of a stretch from what we were just talking about, but I want to bring it in. This is also from Joseph in his book, and I think that he's referring to the Buddha. Better to do an unwholesome deed knowing it is unwholesome than to do it without knowing. If we don't know that something is unwholesome, there's no motivation to change and harm is done. But in knowing that something is unwholesome, even as we might be doing it, then the seeds of wisdom and future restraint are there. Isn't that interesting? I think that's fabulous. So I wonder if, as my employee had that mindless moment, I think it was an impulsive moment. There's money right there. I'm just going to take that. She knew better. Her wisdom was there saying, oh my God, I can't believe I just did this. So then when I was able to talk with her about it, the environment was safe enough for her to say, yeah, I did it. And then for her to tap into her wisdom to say, yeah, I think you should take me off the schedule for a few days. What a good girl. You know what? What a wise young woman. So I do think that when we consciously make decisions or take actions that we know are not for our long-term welfare and happiness and might just be for some perceived short-term gain, we have that inner wisdom that says, you know, maybe that wasn't so smart and we might not do it again. So wisdom takes time to grow. So this goes back to Mary Grace Orr's position of what would my 85-year-old self tell me to do? Because that 85-year-old self, I think, in many ways, we come onto the planet with. So this is increasing, expanding the bottom line of our heart. This is how we expand our profitability. And we need our practice to do this. Then the heart becomes open and stable. Our tolerance expands. Our resilience expands. We are courageous enough to be curious about what is difficult, about what might be painful. And it's expansive. It operates out of a really deep foundation. But it does take courage to be curious about the painful stuff. And then we can really enjoy the pleasant parts of ourselves. We can really rejoice in that. This is from a Korean poet, I believe 17th century. His name is Deng Xiru. The heart is a gold field. Plow it for 100 generations and it is never depleted. Goodness is a perfect treasure. Use it for a lifetime and some will still be left over. Isn't that beautiful? The heart is a gold field. Plow it for 100 generations and it is never depleted. Goodness is a perfect treasure. Use it for a lifetime and some will still be left over. So mindfulness, you know, this is what mindfulness is. And we can all develop our own definitions for it, a working definition. So when you're in the conversation with somebody and it comes up, and somebody who's not a practitioner and somebody says, tell me about mindfulness. We all have stories like the one I just told you, where we have opportunities to take our practice into our lives and to not be afraid to do it, and to remember our sila because our sila supports us, and to notice those times when your practice does support your work. And you can pat yourself on the shoulder and say, whoa, good work. This practice is showing up in my life. It's really supporting me and therefore, by extension, all the people in my life. So give yourself that appreciation and that support and that recognition. when your mindfulness practice really shows up in that way. Take pride in that. That's valuable. So I think I'll end there, and we have time for questions. Or if you would like to share any of your own experiences of when your practice has shown up for you that's really made a difference, that'd be great. I'd love to hear that too. Anybody? I think we have a traveling mic. Great. When you get the mic, will you say your name for me, please? Thank you.
Just hold it up close.
My name is Whitney Reed, and one thing that I've been practicing now for about 17 years, and yesterday I had a conflict with a friend, and there was a lot of, instead of I messages, there was a lot of you messages. Mm. And I felt a lot of shame arise, like I'd done a lot wrong, you know? And, but I was really grateful for my practice because I was able to track back to my intentions, you know, when I made the actions. And I just remembered that my intentions were good. Maybe they were perceived in not the right way or miscommunicated. But I was able to take a moment and just appreciate my good intentions. And then also I felt this kind of inner confidence of like, well, maybe this person, has a certain reaction to my actions. And instead of getting caught up in my story of whether they like me or not, or I'm doing good, I kind of turned to my practice. I'm like, well, at least I have this practice to find stability, where I noticed a moment of wanting to reach to them to find stability and be like, no, I was right. Like, this isn't wrong. I've instead turned to my own mind and my own practice to find that stability.
That's really important. Thank you for sharing that, because that sounds painful. That it was a painful experience to feel the shame. And at the same time, to turn to your practice. I had somebody said in a group recently, when I sit down to practice, I feel like I'm visiting an old friend. Was it like that at all?
Yeah, it was.
That's great. So rely on that. And I do think your point about intention is critical. That when we keep our motivations and intentions in mind and alive and we're aware of them, we're much more likely to act from a wholesome place. And even if our actions land on somebody in a way we didn't intend, then we can deal with it. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that. Anybody else? Yeah, Adrian.
One of the things that impressed me about your story with your employee is your patience. And the role of patience in, well, not doing something stupid, right? But the role of patience in believing that of letting things unfold a little bit, like having principle and, but having the, I don't know if it's the practice of mindfulness that allows this or the belief that, or the non-attachment to outcome. I'm not sure what it is that allows the patience, but I think it's a grace that happens through practice that allows us to let some of it happen, let things unfold without intervening in a way that could be destructive.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that that was a way that the practice came out. But I will tell you, I had a very sleepless night. So I really did. I was really thinking about how did I want this to come out and how did I, what was really going to be in the best interest of everybody. And I really did have to think about how can I be patient with this and let this unfold. So yeah. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Debbie.
Thank you, Debbie.
Wanted to talk about what you said in the beginning about how people don't understand that mindfulness involves a lot of being in the muck, you know, I guess when we're sitting, you were thinking of. And for me, and I sit almost every day, the way that it works is a little bit different. When I'm just in my daily life, going about my life, there's a lot, you know, of unpleasantness happening, you know, sometimes, and things that my mind is, you know, racing and stuff and worried about this and worried about that. And then when I sit, I'm usually able to, it's not there. You know, I sit and if something starts to come in, I can put it to the side, like, you know, like we're instructed a lot. And the sitting is kind of a pretty, and I'm alert, but it's usually pretty peaceful and just kind of a, you know, it feels nice. It's almost like replenishing. But I don't, sometimes it would be almost nice for the hard stuff to come up while I'm sitting, because then I could maybe, I don't know, process it somehow. But for me, it doesn't work that way.
I'm so glad you brought that up. So we're all really different. And I think that because you have this peace in your sitting practice, enjoy it. Just enjoy it, you know? Has anybody else feel that way, that for them, when you sit, that you don't have muck?
Sometimes.
So that's great. So maybe this is my problem. But I do think that we're all so different, and I think that practice goes in cycles. And maybe there will be a time where difficulty does come, and when it does come, you will have the tools to manage that in your sitting. And maybe it won't. Maybe it just won't. So I don't mean to be so broad and general and say it's like this for everybody. But my point about that mindfulness can bring us into discomfort is that we do learn to be with the unpleasant, even if it's a backache. You know, it doesn't have to be the kind of unpleasant that rocks our world, but we do learn to manage both pleasant and unpleasant. And so my point about the gaping hole was that I felt like there wasn't a conversation about what about the difficulty. But I'm so glad for you that your practice is peaceful.
You know, maybe on a retreat, that's different. You know, so maybe when teachers such as yourself talk about that, which they do a lot about how mindfulness can be really hard and you're in the muck and stuff, they're thinking more about, you know, retreat practice, where if I'm sitting day in and day out on a retreat, hard stuff comes up.
Are you ever restless in your sitting?
Not usually. I used to be more.
Great. Thank you, Debbie. Anybody else? Yes, over here.
Hi, I'm Bill. I just wanted to express appreciation for something that you wove through even the instructions for meditation, and that was references to equanimity and ultimately the way that you talked about it, that strong spine, or the accessing it through the cold countertop, and what it gives to the support of kindness and compassion, just taking that moment sometimes. So again, thank you. It was a big gift to me today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased. Elizabeth, back here. I don't think it's on. I don't think it's on.
It is.
Oh, is it?
It's kind of cycling between red and...
Maybe just hold it right up to your mouth.
Okay, I'll do it. That's better, right?
thinking about yourself in your 80s. I'm in my 80s, and my feeling is that being in my 80s, I have so much to learn, a whole new layer of things to learn. It's very exciting, and it's wonderful. It's very joyous. I feel as if I have all the time in the world also, because I retired finally.
Congratulations.
And I know I don't. It will stop. But until that point, I have all the time in the world to really practice and hopefully to learn.
What a gift. And very wise, right? Very wise.
Maybe. I have so much to learn.
We have time for one more. Yes, right here.
I hate to go to the what ifs, but...
Can you tell me your name, please?
Julianne.
Julianne, thank you.
But I'm curious if that scenario didn't go in such a beautiful way at the laundromat that this person... denied, though you knew. I mean, what, how would that have been?
How that would have been is I would have terminated her employment in that conversation. And I would have told her I was sad because that's how I was. I mean, I was hopeful. I was really hopeful, but I was prepared. And that was really... really what I felt is I would have been sad and I was prepared. And I had already worked out what I would have done with the schedule and how I would have done the immediate emergency reshuffle. And I would have had to have hired somebody right away. So, and that certainly has happened. You know, as an employer over many years, it happens. So I was just prepared.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So we will end there. It's such an honor to come be here with you all. I will be back on March 2nd, and I really do want to send a lot of love out to Donald and Bernice. I really hope she's doing well, and I hope you're okay. I'm sorry that happened. So, may our practice truly be for the benefit of ourselves and others. May everybody everywhere, may our happiness grow, may it continue, may we be safe. May our lives unfold with ease and love.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.